Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
A letter turned deadly. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
I know where you live. I've been observing your house and know you have children. This is no joke. Please take it serious.
I love a good, like, small town drama, like, mystery. Everyone is again. I think about the Twilight Zone episode where the aliens, it's like aliens come to mate. Something in Mayberry Street. This is a good way. This is a good lead. Forgetting the title of a famous Twilight Zone episode where the whole town turns on each other, you know, and it's like they think it's something externally and it's them. It's all inside of them and they wreck each other. I love a story like that. So,
and that could, that really, it's like the pressure cooker of a small town is the best place for that.
Exactly. The expectations.
Things are too spread out. I think some of the best, obviously, you know, even true crime stories are a small town because everyone sort of seems to know each other instead of something being really, really spread
out.
The
anonymity of a big city is its own thing. Like, that's its own mystery, its own, like...
Yeah. Getting chewed up in the big city.
But small town, it's like, you know everyone, you know their relatives, you went to school with them, they're your mailman, your hair cutter, your grocer. Like, that's the fun, psychological, crazy shit that I love. And it's like, who done it? So I am going to bring you the story of Circleville, Ohio, the place where people were getting mailed letters telling them about their fate and their most intimate secrets, and people fucking died.
Whoa.
Yeah, you ready?
So they got, it's like doxing, but like pre-internet, I'm guessing.
Yeah. This is very pre-internet. Not super, I mean... Again, it's the 70s through the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
So people, no smartphones. We're not talking like flip phones. We're not talking Sidekicks. We're not even talking like a beeper, buzzer.
Pager. Both those.
Yeah.
If you're a doctor, it's a beeper. If you're a drug dealer, it's a
like
pager.
Two Dixie cups with a string. Yeah. I don't know. None of that shit. We just had basic landlines and a will to keep living that was being threatened.
I love it.
I know. It's going to be great. So let me just introduce you first to the cast of characters, shall I? First, we have Mary Gillespie. She's the town bus driver and philanderer. She coquettish. Where's she going? What's she doing? Well, she's certainly not hanging out with her husband, Ron Gillespie. Nice guy, upstanding citizen. Then there is Karen and Paul Freshour, Ron's sister and brother-in-law. They get in the mix, too. Oh, they get in the mix. And there's Gordon Massey, who is the superintendent of the local high school. And guess what? He's having sex with Mary Gillespie. Huh?
Oh, boy. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. And then there's Sheriff Radcliffe, who is the Circleville sheriff. So know these people. Now you get your tool belt. And now let's get into it. I'm going to take you to 1976, Circleville, Ohio.
Was it the bicentennial? Or was the... It's bicentennial. 1976 was 200 years of the United States.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're right.
That was a big
1776?
Year. Yeah.
That doesn't have much to do with the story, but...
I just like to reference the United
context.
States of America.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Sorry.
What a patriot.
Oh, I know. Oh, today only, though.
It's like a flag waving behind you. All right, so now you guys have that info. Ohio residents began receiving strange letters detailing personal information about their lives. Again, Mary Gillespie, bus driver, accused of supposedly not having a non-existent affair with the superintendent of the schools. And he was like intended of all the schools too. The writer of this letter, so she received this letter, told Mary that he or she had been observing her house and knew that she had children. It was postmarked Columbus, Ohio, but had no return address. Within 8 days, Mary received a similar letter. She kept the letters to herself until her husband, Ron, received one also. The letter stated that if Ron did not stop his wife's affair, his life would be in danger. Can you imagine just like, hey, I got this letter about my life being in danger because you're having sex with someone. This is also like a very Midwestern thing. Like in the Midwest, you don't talk about stuff like this. if there's any disgrace happening, anything, you keep it under wraps, you keep it under layers and layers of guilt and shame and public politeness. That's just the Midwestern way. So this story is
It's blowing wide open.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. This letter is like a modern day Gossip Girl, you know, where it's like, okay, well, nothing is safe. So after 2 weeks, the writer threatened to go public with the affair allegations, broadcasting it on TV, CBS radio, CB radios, not CBS radios.
That's pretty big syndication for
this. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty, a lot of Circleville heat and billboards. They were also like, it will also go on a billboard.
Like that Mary, three billboards, Ron. Three billboards movie.
Yeah, yeah, it's one terrifying billboard in Circleville, Ohio. Oscar nom? Anyone?
Yeah.
Silence? Okay. Crickets?
Nope. Okay.
Okay. Moving on. Mary and Ron only told three people about the letters. Ron's sister, her husband Paul, and Paul's sister. So those are where the fresh hours come in. And I can't tell if it's fresh hour, whatever. I'm saying fresh hour because that's a cool name. Mary had some ideas about who might be sending the letters. They decided to have Paul write letters to the suspect, claiming that they know who he or she was. So this seems like a pretty bad plan. Just a in-law writing letters back. So, but it did seem to work. The plan happened. He wrote these like threatening letters back to the person.
And we know basically, it's a he?
No, we don't know it's he. Okay. So I'm just using he or she kind of interchangeably. Like the day, but they would just write the letter, put it like in the mailbox where they got the letters, and the letters were taken. So they were, this is also very creepy because they were being watched clearly. You know, all of this was being monitored by somebody and they didn't know where, when, or how. But the letter stopped for several weeks. That changed on August 19th, 1977. Ron received a phone call from the alleged writer. Yeah, plot thickens. We got a voice. The call seemed to confirm Ron's suspicions on the identity of the writer. He grabbed his gun and then left his pickup truck, even though the writer claimed to be watching the truck. A few minutes later, Ron was found dead in his pickup truck, crashed into a tree.
Whoa.
Yeah. Ron Gillespie crossed that name off.
And he was suspect the one. Gone. He was the one who had the he's the only one who had the information.
Yes.
Yeah.
He and it again, died with it's him. Hard to know. Yeah, it died with him, and he thought he knew who it was, but he didn't tell. He wasn't like, I'm going out to my truck to figure this out. He was like, huh? Minimal information, went to his truck, dead. Damn, right?
Wow, okay.
Woo. Investigators later learned that Ron had fired at least one shot from his gun before crashing. Sheriff Dwight Radcliffe questioned and eliminated at least one suspect in the case. He then ruled Ron's death as an accident, claiming that he lost control and crashed while driving drunk. I don't know where the timeline is of the gun being fired, but I don't know, Sheriff. I don't know if I buy it. Several residents soon received letters stating that Sheriff Radcliffe had been involved in a cover-up. According to Paul, Sheriff Radcliffe initially agreed that the death was a result of foul play. However, he allegedly changed his mind when the suspect passed a polygraph test. Ron's blood alcohol level was a 0.16, which was twice the legal limit. However, many of Ron's friends and family were surprised by this. They never knew him to be a heavy drinker. Someone just ply him with alcohol, put a gun. Like, what is happening? And how is the sheriff involved? And why would he cover it up?
It's a setup.
Mary and the superintendent later acknowledged their relationship, finally. Although they claimed that it didn't start until after the letters were sent. Which everyone knows, like, the best aphrodisiac or, like, love happening is threatening letters. In February of 1983, Mary was harassed along her bus route. The letter writer apparently began placing threatening signs next to the road. He is hitting, or she is hitting on all media. You know, we're getting phone calls.
It's escalating.
We're getting billboards. We're getting letters. Exactly. One day, Mary had enough and decided to go and rip one of the signs down. When she did, she discovered a booby trap designed to kill her. A booby trap! This story has everything! The trap had a box which contained a small pistol, like a tiny lady pistol. If Mary had pulled the sign off a certain way, the gun would have fired. Is this not, like, insane?
Because the thing is that this person who did it must have assumed that she... What if it was, like, somebody was like, oh, I don't want to... This is a dumb sign. I'm going to pull this off. Like, a bystander.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and all... Yeah. The sign was just left up there until she... They knew that she was finally going to kind of get sick of it and do something to the sign versus anyone else in that tiny town.
Yeah. I just wonder, like, if it didn't go as planned. Like, if somebody else decided to pull a
sign. No, I mean, it already didn't, but yeah. Why? How did they assume that nobody else would have tampered with the sign? That would have been even more interesting, though, if some other random person had been roped into this thing. I don't know.
Well, people are, you know, when we talk about being polite, maybe they're just like, hey, it's not my sign.
Not my sign.
It's not about me.
It threatens woman, but, like, that's their business. Yeah. It's not our business.
It's still a sign.
Oh, this is so... This story is so quintessentially Midwestern in the worst way. So an amateurish attempt was made to rub off the serial number on the gun. When lab tests were able to raise the number, it was determined that the gun had belonged to Paul Freshour, her mother-in-law.
Oh, okay.
Who recently separated from Ron's sister. Paul, however, claimed that the gun had been stolen. On February 25th, 1983, Sheriff Radcliffe asked Paul to meet with him and take a handwriting test. He asked Paul to try and copy the handwriting from the letters. The sheriff also had him write the letters while repeating them verbally. After the test, Paul took Sheriff Radcliffe to his garage and showed him where he kept his gun. The two returned to the courthouse, where Paul was arrested and charged with attempted murder. October 24th, 1983, he went on trial for the attempted murder of Mary Gillespie. So we got a suspect. Do we believe it? Hard to say.
Is the motive there?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I, you know.
Why? And also, like, again, what does the sheriff, what's up with this guy? I feel like as I was researching this, I was like, this ain't right. This guy is too meddling, involved in these things, thinking that the first death in the truck was just him being drunk. I don't know. Although he was never charged with writing the letters at all, they became a crucial part of the evidence against him. A handwriting expert testified that Paul was the letter writer. Mary also testified that she believed that he was the writer after his wife visited her with the same suspicion. Paul's boss also testified that he was not at work on the day that the booby trap was found. Although, again, it was just hiding there. So that doesn't really mean anything to me.
Yeah, that alibi is like...
Mm-hmm. But Paul had an alibi for most of the day, but he never told this in his defense. Proclaiming his innocence, he was convicted and was given a 7 to 24-year sentence. While there, he himself received letters from the writer determined to keep him there. The letters keep coming. Or was he writing his own letters to himself?
Yeah, or is it a copycat? Is it, you know, is there somebody else involved to, you know, to be like, hey, start writing some, hey, send out some letters.
So yeah.
It takes the heat off of me.
Other people that maybe are vindictive.
He had an alibi, but he's just like, you know what? I'm not
going to use it. Like, why wouldn't you use it though?
You know what? I'm 7 to 24 years. I'd rather.
I'll wait it out.
I mean, what was something like so embarrassing?
Midwestern, you know? Man. Yeah. I don't know. But other letters came to other people while he was in jail, postmarked from Columbus, even though he was in prison elsewhere. And he was in solitary confinement too, which sucks.
And so, that, well, I guess the handwriting was the same.
Yeah. They didn't say. So according to the blog that Trail Went Cold, this is why Paul was perhaps innocent. And this is really it's already so insane, but all this stuff like kind of adds up and kind of doesn't. So this is why Paul may have been innocent. Even though Sheriff Radcliffe told the press that Paul had confessed to writing around 40 to 50 threatening letters, Paul denied this and said that if he actually made such a confession, why didn't Radcliffe record it? Paul's fingerprints were not found on the letters, gun, or booby trap. A search of Paul's house failed to turn up any more corroborating evidence, such as ammunition for the gun or material which could have been used to construct the signs and booby trap. Mary Gillespie testified that shortly after her divorce, Paul's ex-wife Karen confided in her that she believed Paul might have been the author of the threatening letters that she had received years earlier. Paul's response was, "If Karen really believed I had done this, why did she never mention it to me in divorce court?" So if they got a divorce, she'd be like, he's a fucking crazy letter writer.
Right.
I need to be away from him. But she never mentioned that when they were getting their divorce. Even though Paul was not working on the day Mary found the threatening sign and booby trap, he had an alibi witness who placed him at his home between 12:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. The prosecution responded with a surprise rebuttal witness who testified that he saw the sign along Mary's route between 11:30 a.m. and 12 p.m. that day, but never noticed the police and no other witnesses reported seeing the sign before Mary found it at 3:30. So, interesting. Even though she said that the sign was there for a while and it was bothering her. Years later, it was discovered that a key piece of evidence was withheld at trial. 20 minutes before Mary discovered the booby trap, another school bus driver driving that route reported seeing a yellow El Camino parked at that spot along with a sandy-haired man who did not match Paul's description. He did match the description of another man Karen Freshour was dating at the time. Even though Paul did not own an El Camino, Karen's brother did. It's a whole family affair. It's family. It's philandering. It's bus drivers. It's sheriffs. Shoe prints were also found at the scene, which did not match Paul's shoe size. After Paul was incarcerated in prison, a bunch of more anonymous threatening letters signed by the Circleville writer, so now he had like a name, like a fun, flashy name, started being mailed to people all over central Ohio. Nobody in Ohio was safe. Even though the letters were postmarked from Columbus, which was 90 miles away from where he was in jail in Lima, Ohio, Sheriff Radcliffe became convinced Paul was somehow sending the letters from prison. In response, Paul was placed in solitary confinement, denied access to writing materials, and was constantly monitored, but the letters kept being sent. The warden maintained that he could have not written any letters from solitary confinement, absolutely not. And he was denied parole at his first hearing in December 1990, so this has been going on for a while. A few days later, Paul was mailed an anonymous letter mocking him for this. How many people could be involved in this, really?
And if all the handwriting's the same,
yeah.
Aren't people like, well, do we have the wrong person?
Yeah, and they don't really talk about the handwriting. Like, in my research much after that, after the conviction of Paul Freshour, he did get paroled in May 1994. So that's a long time in prison for something he may not have done. With the support of an investigative journalist, the Circle of Letters case wound up being featured on Unsolved Mysteries. But while the show was working on the story, their office received an anonymous postcard signed by the Circleville writer, which read, "Forget Circleville, Ohio. Do nothing to hurt Sheriff Ratcliffe. If you come to Ohio, you L sickos will pay."
Translate that for me.
So basically, the Circleville writer... So Unsolved Mysteries had like some production office, right? Yeah. Some like shit production hole. Some, you know, like in a storage unit in Circleville, Ohio. And they get a letter that are like, "Hey, how about... get out of here. You guys are going to pay if you do a thing on me." Signed, love, XOX, the Circleville writer.
You said El Sicko.
El Sickos. Is that just a fun, flashy? I don't know what that means. El Camino? Yeah, El Sicko? Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know if that's just a way to, that's what I was like translated from.
No.
I was
like, El Sicko. Oh, okay. I was like, you sickos? Is that fun youth slang from 1994? Mm. Anyone from 1994 respond to this? Who uses El Sickos?
I was a dad of six in 1994, so probably can't relate.
One of your kids. Exactly. Paul Freshour attempted to clear his name and wrote a letter to the FBI asking them to investigate Ron Gillespie's death, but nothing ever came of it, and he passed away in 2012. A lot of people think that it was a frame-up job orchestrated by Karen Freshour in response to her and Paul's divorce. Like, so Karen dating this guy who was in El Camino with Sandy Hare during the booby trap, maybe he was involved. So they think it was her. Paul's gun was hidden in his garage after Paul went to prison. Karen regained custody of their children and the house. So things went pretty well for her.
Motive.
It's suspected the original series of letters from 1977 were written by a man named David Longberry, a school bus driver who worked alongside Mary Gillespie and was angry that she had rebuffed his romantic advances. The plot continues to thicken.
Because when it's a small town, mm-hmm. everyone has the information.
Yeah.
So it can be...
Yeah,
you know
exactly. So let's take a little break, and we'll get back to Longberry and some other intrigue.
Oh, I like that. And we're back.
Yeah, and we are back.
We are back.
We are here. We are back. How's everyone feeling?
I have something that's not a mystery at all.
Oh,
some nice messages
from people
on Instagram.
Oh,
that's always nice, right?
Yeah.
We have Drew Aldridge. He's like,
oh, you know what? He is a friend of mine's ex-boyfriend.
Is it really?
Yeah, I've never met him.
Oh, okay. About a week ago, at age 36, I was eating a wedge of cheese. Like an apple on my walk back from Trader Joe's where I purchased it.
Atkins?
I feel seen. Love the show. Yeah. Thank you for the podcast excellence twice a week. Oh, now we got to keep doing it twice a week, I guess.
Oh, no.
Like the Friday
How
episodes.
How we ever sustain
Friday.
This.
We love Friday fails, though.
We do. We
Friday
love
fails are fun.
Yeah, we love our meat and potatoes, but we love our dessert afterwards.
Yeah, our candy. Mm-mm-mm. Single_together. Mm-hmm. Hey, I've been listening since day one. I keep meaning to send you all a nice
day
message.
Day one. Oof, sorry.
Yeah. Just trudging along with us. Send you all a nice message and follow you all and stuff. But, you know, procrastination, so here it goes. I love y'all's podcast, the snippets about dating life.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's single together is the
like,
only person.
Moving on.
She's the only one. The funny approach and weird and oftentimes a wee bit depressing topics. I love it all so much. You've helped me through many a traffic jam and insomniac night. Keep on keeping on and producing amazing content. If you do ever do a show in Texas, come to Fort Worth or Austin. I drive four hours to see you, which...
4 hours, no more, no less.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty nice.
Yeah, that is really nice.
Yeah,
sorry we're a wee bit depressing with the murders and cannibalism and other blights on human existence.
Yeah.
But it's all part of the experience, baby.
Also, real quick, because I know everyone loves this part. We're Scott sitting in front of us, a whole bunch of Ghost Town enamel pins.
You hear that?
Yeah.
Pins.
Could be anything. But they're great. They're limited time. If you go to patreon.com/ghosttownpod,
mm-hmm.
you get the pin. We're crunching numbers. We're probably not going to make any money on the pins.
No,
with the
we're
mailing
losing
and
money
shipping.
Always.
We're probably going to be losing money. No big deal. But
we don't care.
Patreon helps us with some of the editing, mm-hmm. submitting stuff to festivals, some marketing stuff. So if you want to support, get 2 bonus episodes a month,
mm-hmm.
you know, to do it up.
Yeah, and they are fun.
Yeah.
We promise fun and money loss.
So send us a message, you know, Instagram, Ghost Town Pod, and mm-hmm. patreon.com/ghosttownpod to get a sweet pin. Mm-hmm.
They are so cool and so sweet.
They are actually, they came out really.
Yeah, they came out really well. We were both very impressed.
I was winging it.
Yeah.
The pins are better than the show.
Yes.
What would you say? Like
a lot of things are better than the show.
Yeah.
Let's just get that out there.
The pins are better.
These pins deliver
yeah.
in that way. And so if you have a jean jacket that needs some adorning, like, we're here for you.
Yeah. It's just like real funky. It's the, you know, we know what it is, but the green looks good.
Exactly.
It's like
green compliments everybody. Yeah. Everybody's complexion.
It'll bring out your eyes.
Yeah. Ears, mouth, lips,
money,
hips, fingertips.
Yeah. It'll bring out that sweet, sweet cash.
Yeah. We want it.
Yeah. We do want it. And then we have an episode on Fridays for the time, at least for now. We like fail-based stuff. So if you want to like just hear about some, I'd say misfortune, that they're not always super tragic, and they're not always like kind of on topic of what we're talking about. They sort of are in the world.
They really are, because I think a lot of what we talk about with the places that we go to are failures, human failures, architectural failures, historical failures. So we kind of take it to the next level. They're really lighthearted. They'll bring you into the weekend. They'll keep you going.
Yeah.
You know?
It might be your whole weekend.
Yeah. Spiritually. Anyway, let's get back to Circleville.
Yeah.
Let's figure out what's happening in Circleville. So they thought it was this other guy, right? David Longberry, who was a bus driver who worked with Mary Gillespie, who he hit on her. She was not having it. And so he went ballistic. Now, he was a wanted fugitive after a rape charge and committed suicide while on the run. So we will not know the truth about
him. I mean, but could, you know, in 2019, if you wanted to, could you go back and look at those, you know, even the handwriting samples?
Yeah. I went to a LAVA lecture, which is LA Visionaries Association, and they do these true crime lectures, and they talk about the technology involved and how you can get kind of go back. But I think, like, with DNA and stuff like this, where this is just, like, just on the precipice of DNA technology, and if you had something and they were in the system, you could go back retroactively and see if things match. But I don't think that they had a lot of stuff, especially in the small town. I don't think they collected a lot of things.
Go back to his high school and look through some of his, you know, term papers.
Yeah.
If they were hand, you know, whatever he has handwritten. I mean, that's just, you know, listen, I'm watching.
You're going to crack this case.
I watch Mindhunter, so you know what I mean? I'm pretty much
yeah,
an expert.
Yeah, you're LAPD.
Yeah, pretty much.
Just
better.
Put him up.
Better.
Exactly. But that would have been a great helicopter cue.
I know. Where is it? Where's our helicopter?
Helicopter list. It's kind of boring. It's a quiet evening in Los Angeles. No helicopters. Anyway, so we don't know about him. We don't know what's going to happen. Interesting side note. Horrible end to a horrible person. But it's possible that the Circleville letters was two different stories that were linked together when Karen Freshour used the original series of letters as inspiration to concoct a plot.
Copycat.
To frame. Yeah, what you were talking about. Where it's like she can piggyback on this thing to get what she wanted. Which seemed, honestly, it seems easy. She's like, I'll just keep writing letters. Because there was nothing quite like the first letters with the secrets, really. All the letters after were kind of just more like vague and threatening, right?
And like you said, you're piggybacking off the ideas and the information that was given. So you just assume like it's the same person.
Yeah, just
they
copy that
tone.
Just use El Sicko a couple times and you're in. You know, you just do it. Journalist Martin Yant has investigated the story and found another possible suspect that could be the writer of these letters. He discovered that 20 minutes before Mary found the booby trap, another bus driver on Mary's route had seen a suspicious man standing next to a yellow El Camino. The man was at the same spot where the trap would later be found. Yant found that the possible suspect's brother owned the same type of car. So it's like, okay, so now the guy in the El Camino could have been Karen's boyfriend or Paul's brother. The description doesn't match Paul, but again, he has a solid alibi. When Unsolved Mysteries was filming the story, they received a postcard. So, and they were like, this could be anybody. At this point, we're here, we're filming, it's a high-profile case. Everyone just, any eighth grader, sit in a quarry, write a letter, get famous, something like that. So the original air date for the Unsolved Mysteries episode is November 11th, 1994. Sheriff Dwight Radcliffe and Mary Gillespie declined to be interviewed for the story. Interesting moment. And then also, not mentioned in the segment, Paul allegedly admitted to Sheriff Radcliffe somewhere around this time that he had written between 40 and 50 of the letters. An admission, again, not recorded, again, to the sheriff, who I find very questionable. So the identity remains unrevealed. Paul Freshour also had a blog for several years, and he talked a lot on the blog about this and about the case and trying to find out about it, but he never knew the identity or never figured it out. If it was him or not remains to be seen. The historian Martin Yett that we talked about before suggested that there were at least three letter writers involved in the case, none of whom were Paul. One was the son of the superintendent who Mary had an affair. It's just like, keep bringing people in. The son of the superintendent who Mary had an affair with. The second was a coworker who was infatuated with Mary. The third was Paul's ex-wife, Ron Gillespie's sister, Karen. And then the boyfriend of her that was in the El Camino on the day that the booby trap was discovered. One of her relatives had owned that type of car at the time. Despite the evidence, all of this, the police still maintain that Paul was the Circleville writer. Now, we'll never know. We'll never know the truth behind this case.
They seem to be, that narrative seems to be the one that they're, no matter what.
They're really shoehorning it into that. But I, the sheriff to me, like, I don't know how you feel, but the sheriff to me seems like he was meddling a ton. Seems like he, a lot of information was like being, he was the conduit of a lot of very important information that nobody really got or received firsthand, which I found incredibly suspect. But then, yeah, I guess Karen probably also didn't bring up the letter during the divorce case.
To use it.
Yeah, because she was doing it.
Because so, yeah, that's why. Because she, if she admitted, they could be like, well, yeah, you talked about it in the thing, so you had.
Yeah.
You knew enough about it to do it.
Yeah. What do you think?
I feel like just based on this, that, and based on, you know, a lot of people like solving a lot of things and finding a lot of things mm-hmm. way further back than the 70s through the 90s.
Yeah. You think we're going to crack this? They're back. Fine. We missed you.
Maybe they're just, they're trying to be like, we don't want you talking about it.
Yes. Stop it. Shut your mouth. What if I took a letter out of like my mail pile over here and it was.
Stop talking about it.
Columbus, Ohio. Ooh. I know your secret. You had sex with a guy at the pack.
And then you send him a pin.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thanks. You're welcome. Thanks for your support. Yeah. Thank you.
We love you. Mm-hmm. That you, I think the fact that you said like the sheriff was, you know, funneling all the information. Mm-hmm. If let's pretend that the sheriff is not in. Partial. If mm-hmm. you had an impartial person that allowed other people to have other opinions inside, beside mm-hmm. the fact of the scenario that it was Paul,
yeah,
that I feel like it could be a relatively easy solve to find one of the people, mm-hmm. you know, with certainty.
Yeah.
I just don't see how it's handwritten letters.
I know. Also, at a certain point, maybe someone just bored and they're like, maybe I'll just talk to people about it. Maybe I'll tell people that I wrote a letter or two. Back in 1984, you know?
Yeah, but if you put all these, I mean, because the letters were available to see and look at, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you could spread them all out and be like, okay, so
what do we got here?
The type of paper, the penmanship, mm-hmm. the handwriting, the language. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you went to a thing, that's a tell, you know
yeah,
what I mean? The way
absolutely.
You curve some of your letters, you know, the way, what you punctuate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like when people type things as comments, there's a certain, I'm sure there are like kind of forensics of like what kind of person capitalizes the first letter of every word.
Yeah.
When totally. I see that, I was like, oh.
Psychopath.
Yeah, sort of. They might not be, but
yeah, it's too much work.
But there's got to be something to be said with that. And that's, you know, all the letters are the same. It's just how are you, so when it's handwriting, I feel like you can analyze that and glean something from mm-hmm. it, but you can't have a sheriff that's holding on to a lot of information mm-hmm. and a seemingly like tight-lipped group of people that have motives.
Yeah. Yeah.
All these people have some kind of motive. Boredom is a motive, mm-hmm. but also jilted lovers is a huge motive.
I mean, one thing we do know for certain is Mary Gillespie was kind of a hot commodity. All these guys wanting to know her better.
Yeah.
Hitting on her, affairs. Like, what a rich life.
Yeah, and I guess people probably gossip, people talk, so it's not hard to find the information out, mm-hmm. but it's like everything is evidence.
Yeah.
It's not just word of, like, somebody yelling, like, hey, don't do that.
Yeah.
Well, you can't capture that, but mm-hmm. these are, it's just all, it's a paper, you know, you don't leave a paper trail?
It's literally whole, a paper trail.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just, if people care enough, I think, put the work in, I'm sure you could probably, like, with hindsight, mm-hmm. get something out of it.
Yeah, we even know where the letters are. This also feels like very Making a Murderer style, bumbling, idiot law enforcement, piecemeal shit happening all at once, all evidence is lost.
Well, I mean, do you have somebody who died, mm-hmm. and you have somebody who went to prison, so mm-hmm. they're casualties.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have people traumatized.
You know who made out like a freaking bandit? Stationery stores.
Oh.
Just raking
wow,
it in.
Wow. Ohio stationery stores.
Just big
are the
money.
Real people behind this conspiracy. Maybe what? We cracked it!